science is rather conservative. It is dangerous, as a young scientist, to hold a radical view.
Welcome to the Book Society podcast, where we talk to interesting people about interesting books. It's really that simple. Okay, here we go. We're back. We're talking about Stephen Jay Gould's 1991 book, Wonderful Life. And this was, I've only had a few books on this podcast that I felt were like kind of over my head. And this is a, I guess, it feels like it's somewhere in the middle between popular science and something that you really need to be an expert in. He clearly tried to write it for a popular audience, but there's a lot of stuff where he's like, look, you really need to understand these Latin terms in order to understand the point I'm going to make. And I learned a lot from this book. I really enjoyed it, but I've been very excited to hear your take on it because you've got a bit more of an expert. You're an expert in this field, and I just want you to explain to me.
I mean, actually, I picked it because it's not my field, but I enjoyed it enormously. It's paleontology, so I didn't know much about that subject growing up. And this book came out when I was a young faculty member, I think. It was very influential because I hadn't read that many very well-written popular science books, you know, that didn't dumb it down. They were taking on big ideas. And we're also telling a story because good science has to tell a story. And he did all of those three things. Now, we can get to this, but the book has, in the end, been controversial. Stephen Jay Gould is dead now. But even in his lifetime and after it was published, it became controversial. But the basic idea is he's telling the story of the evolution of complex life forms, which happened in the oceans of the Earth. So we can remember that the first 90% of life on Earth for 3 billion years, you would have needed a microscope to see anything that was living. They were all just microbes. And they weren't on the land. There was nothing on the land. It was just in the ocean. And he's telling the story of this Cambrian explosion, as they call it. I mean, it's a metaphor, but it was almost a literal explosion of life forms in the ocean about 500 million years ago that eventually, not too long afterwards, moved onto the land to turn into plants and animals and us.
I guess tell us about the Burgess Shale and its significance to
paleontology. Stephen Jay Gould cut his teeth, and his graduate students, who are heavily featured in the book, cut their teeth on a special formation. So most of us know that fossils exist, but we don't know how rare they are. That only about 1 in 1,000 creatures that die in the past gets fossilized. It's actually very rare to leave a fossil. And most of the fossils are all mashed up and unrecognizable, and the Earth is volcanic and there's erosion and weathering. So fossils are a pretty imperfect history of the past. But there are a few special places where some very interesting geological event occurs, and in Burgess Shale is one of them in Canada. And what happens basically, there's a seismic, on a shallow sea, there's a seismic shift where a whole shelf of land drops into a clay, into a sediment formation, and it entombs an entire ecosystem in a sort of gentle way. And then that mud essentially turns into shale, you know, it gets metamorphized and turns into a rock that you can then inspect. But it's this perfectly intact record of an entire ecosystem. I think the Germans call this a Lagerstätten, these kind of formations. And there's only 7 or 8 around the world that are heavily studied, but they're treasure troves for fossils because they are this amazing snapshot of an entire oceanic ecosystem hundreds of millions of years ago with all the different species all laid out and everything there very well preserved.
Like Pompeii.
Yeah, like Pompeii, exactly. But not by fire, just by suffocation, deposition and suffocation.
And
I guess they did die that way in Pompeii. There was no oxygen.
Yeah, they got buried by the dust.
The dust, yeah.
So the Burgess Shale, from what I gathered, used to be a seabed, and as you said, was rapidly and pretty much completely buried. And so it was fossilized, or all the creatures were fossilized. And this is special and unique because of the way that the fossilization occurred. Soft bits of the creatures were also saved because we have fossils of skeletons and fossils of exoskeletons, but not a lot of fossils of soft bits. So this really is a treasure trove. And the thing that I found so fascinating, maybe you can go into this more, is that it upended, and maybe this is what's controversial about the book, but it upended the idea that life moves from simple to complicated. because what they found in the Burgess Shale was hundreds of life forms that had not continued. They hadn't evolved into anything else. We don't have any modern ancestors of them. And that Stephen Jay Gould, I guess, went from it changed his belief in how evolution works, or this maybe this shaped his belief in how evolution works, that the jerks and creeps,
right?
That there's some scientists who believe that evolution happens in like jerks, where, you know, a bunch of evolution happens and then kind of levels off, and then creeps where, like, and that's what this Cambrian explosion is, that like a bunch of things evolve and a lot of them die and some of them survive. And then the creeps would believe that evolution gets gradually more complicated, and we of course arrive at the apotheosis of evolution, which is us, we think.
Right.
This was a new idea in the 90s, right?
Right. And there's a second connected thing that he pushes that is still heavily debated in his field. And he argues that this proliferation, that there's an element of a lottery about how life evolves. Mm. And this incredible proliferation of exotic forms and creatures on the oceans, where most of them do not continue and do not survive, is unpredictable, is essentially unpredictable, that you could not look at them back in the ocean when they were all prospering and predict which ones would survive and which ones wouldn't. So he characterizes life as a lottery. And the word that he didn't coin, but is used by paleontologists, is contingency. Everything is, you know, highly contingent on chance outcomes and small deviations in the original conditions. And and it's sort of seismic, to use that word, debate in paleontology is between contingency, what Gould became strongly an adherent of through this work and this book, and convergence, which is a very strongly competing idea that says that, no, life finds very common ways to evolve. You know, octopus eyes and human eyes are quite similar, even, and their octopus eyes are actually better because ours are inside out. Mm. But anyway, and we diverged from octopuses 400 million years ago on the tree of life. So you can find all these situations on life, in the evolution of life, where in very distinct lineages evolved similar solutions to the problems of survival. And that's called convergence. And these are these ideas are sort of at war with each other. And he took a very strong position towards contingency, towards the lottery and unpredictability and so on. And he was in a minority through that. He was very eloquent. He was very senior. He pushed his position quite hard. But in the end, he was in a minority. And I think still that would be the case.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. I thought, he did a really good job of describing the, you know, the classic view of evolution, I think, for most of the listeners. If you think of the word evolution, you probably think of that diagram from a sort of a rodent to a monkey to a Neanderthal to a human being. And Gould says in this book that it's more like a gnarled bush and a bunch of dead ends, and that like there's just more life that ever was that we don't have any evidence of than there are branches that continued. And this seems to be supported by, I think of Yuval Noah Harari's work on discovering, I should say at least popularizing, the fact that there were thousands of different hominids on Earth, and we essentially killed them all, and that's why we have the, run of the planet. And that wasn't, that wasn't common knowledge, you know, even half a century ago. So seems like the same idea that there are, lineages that die off. They don't necessarily evolve into higher animals.
Right. I mean, and that's heavily Darwinian, right? Life evolves, adapts into different ecological niches, and some don't survive because the conditions change, because they're not well enough adapted. So it's just a standard part of evolution. Gould's idea, of course, is not wrong. There's nothing wrong about it. He just pushed a very strong version of it, and it got pushback. And I think he was also trying to be corrective to a natural tendency, which is we look at our position as humans, as the smartest creatures, not the wisest on the planet, and we sort of look at it with some air of inevitability. We look back at how we got to be here and almost assume, well, it had to be that way. Because, of course, if you don't do that, then you sort of delegitimize us as top of the pile at some level. So he was making a correction to that. And, of course, we have to talk about, and I do like the book title, which alludes to a classic movie, a Capra movie, where Wonderful Life is the man who, George Bailey, who back in the 30s or whenever it was, who is about to commit suicide because his savings and loan company is going out of business, and he's a good man, and there's bad people in his town. And in despair, he's going to kill himself. And his guardian angel stops him from killing himself and then shows him sequentially through the movie how different his little town of Bedford Falls would have been if he'd committed suicide. So, I mean, I also appreciated first time I read it that Stephen Jay Gould, you know, he's a well-read man. He made this nice allusion to a movie, to an iconic movie of the popular culture, while making his scientific point.
So I grew up in Katona, which is the town that Bedford Falls is modeled after, and I did not make that connection, even though I've realized the titles are the same. But it is very that is a strong point that, like, you know, one of the things that the Burgess Shale shows is what life could have been like if any little tweaks had been different. And he describes these animals that are just fantastical, that he just says, you know, right. and there's diagrams of these things that just look like sci-fi monsters, but they really walked the earth or swam the earth.
And this is not to, again, critique the book, because he was dealing with state-of-the-art research at the time. But, you know, the field has progressed, and it's turned out with hindsight and with extra research that some of his creatures were impossible. They did not exist. Mm. So the reconstructions of some of those fantastical creatures, you know, pushed the envelope of plausibility. And so scientists have reinterpreted a lot of the Burgess Shale fossils, not all of them, but many of them. Mm.
Oh, even since this, because this book was kind of about a reinterpretation of many of them.
Oh, yeah. But this is still, Burgess Shale is still a go-to place, and there's a new fossil discovery. So, yeah, the Burgess Shale story is still being told by scientists.
Wow. Yeah, one of the things that he talked about, or I guess this was sort of an undertone of the whole book, was just the idea of scientific orthodoxy holding back what he believed was progress. And I think this is a pretty common, almost a trope in any kind of story of science. And can you think of an example where scientific orthodoxy has been good and positive? I mean, what is the, because like you always hear these stories of like, well, we discovered this new thing, but the darned establishment wouldn't let us publish our findings.
Right. So I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, in my career, I've had a few slightly oddball ideas. I mean, the thing that people always should remember, especially non-scientists, is that most sort of wild, seemingly harebrained scientific theories are just wrong. You know, I mean, that's right. That's just the case, right? So if you want to bet on a winner, then the conventional wisdom, it does often turn out to be right. But the general point is that, yes, if science as an activity gets too conservative with a little c, that's a problem, because, you know, you will squash out alternative viewpoints. And I think in my view of the field I'm in and other fields that I know about, science is rather conservative. You know, it is dangerous as a young scientist to hold a radical view. And because at the time you hold it, you may be ahead of your time, but being way ahead of your time is seriously dangerous for building a career. You want to be just slightly ahead of your time, right? Not way ahead of your time.
Financially dangerous. Like you might have trouble finding a job.
Trouble keeping your colleagues and friends. Yeah, I mean, it's brutal. I mean, the socio-scientific culture is a little unforgiving to radicals and people who don't fit in. You don't have to be radical at the Bruno level and get burned at the stake, or the Wegener level and think of continental drift and die destitute because nobody believed you. So there are some very sad stories of people who are absolutely right and ahead of their time, and it didn't help them much at all.
Do you really lose friends in science over radical theories?
Well, I'm just being slightly facetious, but a little bit, because it's a tribe. Scientists are a tribe, just like any other tribe, and you want to belong to the tribe. You have the same funny handshake and wear the same silly hat at the meetings, and holding similar ideas, you know, being too unconventional, is going to make you stand out. Now, maybe the friends you lose are people you didn't want to be friends with anyway, and you should have called friends, but I think there's a little bit of that.
I'm a composer by trade, and one of the unpopular opinions I hold is that I think Stravinsky's Rite of Spring is boring.
Okay.
And it is widely considered among composers to be a work of 20th century genius that you should spend your life studying. And every time I listen to it, every time I look at the score, I just don't see it. I don't see what everybody else sees. And I have gotten into heated arguments about this.
James Joyce, your Ulysses is unreadable.
Yeah.
And should not be read. Yeah. But it spawned hundreds of PhD theses, so that's okay.
Yeah. But can you think of an example where scientific orthodoxy is good?
Well, I'll think in my field of cosmology, I think Big Bang is scientific orthodoxy. The universe started in an incredibly hot, dense state nearly 14 billion years ago. I mean, it was a wild idea when it was first put out there, but it's become orthodoxy. And the reason I don't think it's a bad orthodoxy is it's basically the competition of the field has really pushed people to push the theory to its limits. So like, okay, it's orthodoxy, but how far back? Can we go back a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang? Can we go back to the unification of all the forces and test multiverse theory and brain theory and string theory? You know, so I think the orthodoxy there has challenged people to go into some pretty extraordinary places of space-time to try and understand the origin of the universe. So that may be a good example.
Oh, interesting. What else can you tell us about the Big Bang that we might not already know?
I mean, since we're talking about evolution, again, the average person, I'm present company accepted, or in this room, I don't think most people realize that its epistemological status, its likelihood to be correct, is very high. I would put it at the same level as Darwinian evolution. I don't think most people really. They just think, oh, it's some idea scientists have, but other scientists have other ideas. It really is very hard to pull it down to completely nuke it as a theory is, I think, very unlikely and be hard to do because the bar is set so high. There's so much data that it explains. And if you have some brand new theory, you have to explain all that data and then some new data that the Big Bang doesn't explain. And that's getting harder and harder.
How do you teach this at the Vatican?
Big Bang?
Yeah.
Just straight up, because the Vatican, the Jesuit astronomers are those rare species of people, men, who have a double, they live a double life. They're all priests with parishes and they're all PhD astronomers and they have no problem with the Big Bang or general relativity. You know, they will drop back to a creator of the entire enchilada, but after the Big Bang, it's physics. And that's how they think about it.
And I guess you just don't get into that with them.
Oh, I do get into that. I used to teach cosmology with one of the Jesuit astronomers, and he's a relativist. He worked on general relativity. And I tease him a number of ways because I couldn't resist. But first of all, I'd say, Bill, you have to believe three impossible things before breakfast every day, you know, virgin birth, reincarnate, etc. And then I'd say, well, you know, Bill, your God of the gaps is squeezed all the way back into the Planck time, you know, 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the Big Bang, because physics got the rest.
That is a solid physics burn right there.
Yeah.
Your God of the gaps is squeezed back into Planck time. Wow. I'm gonna steal that one. But I wonder, I you know, kudos to the Vatican for inviting you to teach that stuff to them. It's very,
yeah. I mean, they very, yeah. they do have, you know, and this of course is part of their progression that Francis is a Jesuit, of course, and from their same tribe as the Vatican astronomers, and he's very pro science. And he's, but even John Paul, you know, was you like this. So when John Paul II started hosting science conferences in this Vatican city state, which was unusual at the time. So he was socially very conservative, but he supported science too. The awkward moment came when they had a conference on cosmology and physics, and Stephen Hawking was there. And he, in his little address, Stephen Hawking relegated God to a boundary condition. And that probably didn't go too well among the curia.
Wow. Yeah, that is not what he said in the burning bush, to my recollection. That's fantastic. Is there any evidence of the Big Bang that the average person can just see?
It's hard because the best evidence is the microwave background radiation, which is invisible microwaves. But if you have an old, as I tell my students, if you have an old style TV, get an old analog TV, you know, a tube TV, and tune it between stations, and you see all the speckles and the phosphor, A few percent of the speckles are interactions of the phosphor with microwave background. So you can be a radio astronomer. And I always also tell them, you know, whatever cable package you have, there's some nights when it's all crap and you just should stay in and watch the Big Bang, crack a beer and watch the Big Bang. And it's very zen. But that's facetious because that's radio waves. It's really not intuitive at that level. I mean, the helium in the universe, 1/4 by mass, is only explicable in terms of what happened in the first few minutes after the Big Bang. So there's way too much helium in the universe to be explained by all the stars that make helium. So that's all around us as sort of evidence that something strange happened, something extreme happened very early on.
When you're talking about, I guess, a few minutes before the Big Bang or a few minutes into the Big Bang, when you're talking about an object with, you know, almost infinite mass and almost infinite density, what is the meaning of the term minute?
Right. So astronomers, relativists, general relativity has a way of defining time. It's called conformal time. So there is a way of defining time internally within the physics of a situation. But you're right. There's no external reference for it. The first 3 minutes were when the universe itself was the same temperature as the center of the sun, which is why it was making helium. And obviously, you know, normal clocks and iWatches don't survive in that condition. So you can't have that kind of time. And also even radioactive decay, which is normally how we can measure time reliably, that couldn't exist back then. So you actually do need a purely theoretical concept of time.
Do you think, or do you have or do you know whether the universe is going to expand infinitely into a state of frozenness, or do you think it's going to contract back into do another round of big banging?
The best evidence is endless expansion and a sort of, you know, cold, very cold, dissipative death. That was true even before dark energy was discovered in the mid-90s, because there wasn't enough mass, normal mass and dark matter, to overcome the expansion and do a bouncing universe. The bouncing universe sort of been ruled out for a long time. But then when we found dark energy, that's causing accelerated expansion. So that's making it fly apart even faster. And if nothing seems on the cards to turn that around, then yeah, it's just going to dissipate like crazy, which means astronomers have to have fun now, because in not terribly long, all the galaxies will be carried away so fast we can't see them with telescopes and we'll be staring at our navels.
Wow. But by fast, you mean like that's going to happen in a couple million years?
A couple hundred million years.
Yeah, you better get right on it.
Yeah.
What is dark energy?
It's nobody knows. So it's the phrase itself is a container for ignorance. It's just the agent, unknown physical entity that causes space-time to accelerate in its expansion. So all that we understand that space-time is expanding faster and faster, and the galaxies are the measure of that. And that was good enough to get a Nobel Prize some years ago. So we think the observation is true, but what's causing it, what dark energy is physically, we do not have an idea. There's hundreds of papers a year written on dark energy from a theoretical standpoint, but there's very little progress on what it actually is.
Do the Vatican astronomers like to point to that as, you know, well, you don't know this, so maybe that's Jesus?
That would be a different God of the gaps. That's a Jesus of the vacuum, if you like. But so they don't tend to do that. They're pretty good. They kind of stick to their lane. When they're doing science, they do science. They don't deny the existence of miracles, of course, you know, which is pretty extreme level of intervention from some entity in the physics of the universe. But, you know, I can give them that. But otherwise, they just, you know, they do their thing in the way that all normal astronomers do.
Wow. Do you ever ask them to pray for you?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I would, but I haven't asked them because they would know that it was a disingenuous request.
Oh, yeah, that's funny. I always ask religious people to pray for me.
Yeah, I mean, right. What's the harm?
Yeah, why not?
What's the harm? Yeah. Yeah. It's like that great story of Niels Bohr. He won the Nobel Prize, and New York Times journalist went out to Copenhagen to interview him at the lab. And they were about to go in the lab, and the journalist looked up, and there was a horseshoe above the door of the lab. And he stopped and says, "Professor Bohr, you know, you're a physicist, rationalist, man of science. Surely you, of all people, are not superstitious." And he just looked at him deadpan and said, "I've heard it works whether you believe in it or not."
Yeah, that's how I feel about prayer.
Right.
You know, that's great. And Man, so let me ask you the last question we ask everyone to end the show, which is to recommend two books to our audience.
The current or older?
I used to do one by a living author and one by a deceased author, but I stopped doing that and could just two books. It's an open question.
Two books is an open question. Yeah. Wow. Well, that's a tough one. I mean, I like Dickens. Great Expectations is I would pick for one of them, just a classic. And then for a more modern one, this is kind of dark, but The Road, Cormac McCarthy.
Wow.
Just because it's so sparse, so elegiac. It's just amazing writing.
That might be the biggest difference between two suggestions that we've had so far. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'd love to have you back when you write your 10th book.
Okay, it would be a pleasure. Thank you.
The Book Society podcast is brought to you by me, Lucas Cantor Santiago, and produced by Chris Peters. We do new episodes on Fridays. We have a lot of episodes. You can listen to some back catalog. If you like the show, please give it a review. You can review it on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Takes a few seconds. Helps out the show, helps other people find it, and we really appreciate it. All right, see you next week.
I was going to be facetious and say Ulysses, but I won't.
You would have been the first one to recommend that.